When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast. It's SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. And it's also sponsored by great people like AMS, S&R Remodeling, and of course, Madison Computer Works. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Before we talk about anything else, I thought it would be an opportunity for you to remember one of your good friends, Ed Garvey.
Yeah, it's a hard loss, Ed Garvey. He was, by any measure, the living embodiment of the La Follette tradition, and particularly for a period in the late 90s there. You know, there are other people who carried forward the La Follette tradition. There's no question that Russ Feingold has. I think Tammy Baldwin in many ways, Mark Pocan, others. But Garvey, there was something about him that made it work on so many levels. Ed was a labor lawyer and had an incredibly successful career in the labor movement. He was the person who in many ways brought the National Football Players League Association into being and into its strength and redefined football by any measure. In fact, rather than me talking about it so much, if people go to the National Football Players League or National Football League Players Association website, they'll see the incredible video that
let me play a minute or so of that.
John Mackey found this young attorney at the time, and he felt that this would be the person to really bring us into the 20th century as far as the union, to organize us, to pull us together. This man has to be the most controversial figure in the U.S. I really believe that you need certain leaders for a certain period of time in history.
When Ed had this job, the philosophical idea that as a player, you should be treated like a worker in America was something that few people could even wrap their heads around. We refuse to be treated like chattel. We refuse to be treated like fungible, discardable entities. And that was something that shook the core of the owners. They hated Ed, not so much because he was smarter than they were.
Al Davis, the genius.
And he was funny.
I hear it all the time. Pays well, takes misfits. So most of you are thinking, I may have a chance.
They hated Ed because he challenged their quote-unquote right to own men.
So the Tex Ram called his team captains in and said, Ed Garvey's a racist. And the player rep said, gee, I find that hard to believe. Tex says, that's the point. He hates whites. He probably thought Marcus Garvey was my grandfather, but whatever.
Ed had the luxury of pushing the union philosophically towards issues that he called freedom issues.
Talk to Calvin Hill. Player rep for Dallas Cowboys, dangerous position, did something awful, raised the question with the Dallas Cowboy management why it was that the white players got cars for nothing from the dealers, but the black players didn't. And Calvin Hill finished his career with a different team.
To take advantage of the rising tide of civil rights.
National Football League still says there's a difference between blacks and whites. Blacks are good on the field, they're not so good off the field. And anyone who has watched this league for all these years, who says there are no qualified blacks to be head coaches and offensive coordinators and general managers and owners of teams, does not deserve to be commissioner of the National Football League in 1987.
When I took this job, obviously, Gene wasn't here. The only person that I could ask questions to, the only person that I could confide with, the only person who understood what it was like to have this job was Ed. And for the rest of my life, I'll never be able to repay that debt.
It was really a very moving tribute.
fabulous. It was so good, and it's so important because, you know, Ed was out of the union game in that sense, out of that leadership role he played with the association for more than 30 years. And so a lot of Wisconsinites didn't know him in that context, or if they knew him in that context, they thought of it as, you know, something kind of distant. And the importance of that is twofold. Number one, it reminds us of what an epic figure Ed Garvey would have been had he never come back to Wisconsin and engaged with the progressive movement in Wisconsin. He would have been an epic figure without a question. The other thing it reminds us of is his remarkable and frankly under-remembered connection to the civil rights movement. And this is a really important thing. Ed Garvey grew up in rural Wisconsin, relatively rural. He grew up in Burlington, Wisconsin, a very Republican town. My mom lives there now. And as a very young man, he was brilliant. He was a good athlete. He was a good student. He got, you know, off to university, became very active in student politics in this National Student Association. He was the president, which is a very big deal. But the important thing about his student days was that he linked his engagement with student politics to the civil rights movement. It was Ed Garvey who, you know, really pulled together this burgeoning sense of student activism with a recognition that there was a need to go south. And Ed Garvey went south. He went down to Alabama and Mississippi in the early 1960s as a kid from rural Wisconsin. And he was such an important part of that movement. And I'm not sure most people know this. He was on the board of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And that's with people like John Lewis and others. And this was as a kid from rural Wisconsin. And he took what he learned there, what he learned from African-American organizers and civil rights activists, into the labor movement and brought a civil rights sensibility, not just to his work with the football players, but also to his solidarity work with other unions and with causes across this country. Do you know, Sly, we could do a whole show, entire podcast, just on the amazing events where Ed Garvey, as a director of the football players association there, where he would bring players to join picket lines. And so you'd have some railroad workers in some rural town out on a picket line, and the stars of their region's biggest football team would show up and march with them. And Ed Garvey was the one who took the call and then called the players, who loved Ed Garvey, and they would go out and join that picket line. That's how Bernie Sanders got to know Ed Garvey. There was a railroad worker strike or some action up in Vermont back in the, I think it was late 70s, early 80s, and Bernie was involved. He called, and Ed Garvey showed up. And I can't begin to tell you how many hundreds of stories there were like that. So here's this guy, incredible civil rights history, incredible labor union and labor movement history. He comes back to Wisconsin in the early 1980s, and there's a whole other story with him that people aren't fully aware of, that he joined the state attorney general's office with Brownson LaFollette, and he took on responsibility as a labor guy for environmental work, and went out and crusaded on environmental issues all over Wisconsin and did incredible work in that regard. And then a whole nother career, right? Civil rights, labor movement, environmental leader. And then he leaves that role, runs for the U.S. Senate, and begins this whole political career, which Wisconsinites are much more aware of.
Well, let's talk about why he came back to Wisconsin. Why did he come back to Wisconsin?
You want to know the truth? I think he came back because he did want to ultimately get involved in politics. You know, I think he had He loved the state. He was hardwired into it, deeply rooted in it. I think he was horrified that his hero, Gaylord Nelson, was defeated in 1980 by Bob Caston. And I think he came back to Wisconsin. He had young family. I think he definitely wanted to settle in someplace, and he thought settling into Wisconsin was a great thing. But I also believe, without a question, that he did, you know, he had in the back of his head, you know, might do some politics, might get into politics. All right. And the opportunity arose in 86, a chance to run against Bob Caston, who had beaten Gaylord Nelson. But the important thing to understand is it wasn't one of these things where all the party leaders got together and said, oh, we
well, no, and let me ask you about that, because in the primary, he ran against Matt Flynn, who was former party chair and a big lawyer in the city of Milwaukee, very much an establishment Democrat. They had a bruising primary. It was very close. And by the way, I just reading about this the other day, I had forgotten that Gary George had run in that race.
Yeah. Well, Gary George ran twice against Ed Garvey. Gary George ran against him in the primary in 1986, and he also ran against him in the primary in 1998. And you know what the weird thing about it is? They liked each other.
Well, it's
it
hard.
Wasn't like that.
Yeah, no, they're both engaging personalities. That is so
for
sure.
They're also both really smart guys. They're very different guys in a whole bunch of ways. But you know,
so Matt Flynn was he didn't beat a nothing. He beat a very capable politician in Matt Flynn. It was very close. He won by 26,000 votes. It was a tough primary win in a very low turnout, which I can't really explain why. So I looked at the map today of his loss to Bob Caston. And it's funny, if you look at the map, you'd say, well, why didn't Caston win in a landslide? Look at all those counties Caston won. You know what's interesting about Wisconsin back then is most of the counties were kind of close. It was kind of a different era. But Bob Caston ran a brutal campaign where he accused Ed Garvey from a book that had not been fact-checked. Basically taking a bunch of the players' unions, M-O-N-E-Y. Later in court, he had to retract that.
Well, I think you're being, and I don't think I've ever said this to you, I think you're being too gentle and too generous.
Well, Bob Caston's a liar. Would that make it?
Bob Caston, who still's around, ran one of the slimiest, most shameless, and awful campaigns in the history of American politics. A campaign that showed Bob Caston to be such a shameless man that he would literally lie about someone's life's work and lie horribly simply for the purpose of confusing the voters briefly enough to save his political hide. And it was such a shameless thing that he did that... You know, usually, just to understand how awful it was, what Bob Caston did, because he was going to lose.
So
you almost never, but I just say this, you almost never have a libel suit come out of a political
campaign. Right? No, that's right.
It's an absurdity, right? You know, campaigns are rough, they're mean, they you can't possibly get traction on a libel suit coming out of a campaign. We know that from just looking at what Donald Trump just did, right? What Caston did was so horrible that when the libel suit was brought, Caston was effectively forced to acknowledge that he spent a ton of money on a campaign ad that was false. And he was forced to acknowledge that it was false. The New York Times headline said, you know, Caston concedes that ad campaign was false. Now, he still shamelessly claimed that he didn't mean to impugn Garvey's reputation.
Yeah.
But as Garvey said, wow, you know, it's a pretty interesting way to spend $200,000. If you didn't mean to impugn my reputation, you just said these things about me. So it was really an awful, awful thing. And the only reason I go into any kind of detail on that is that people need to know that there but for that shameless lie, Ed Garvey would have undoubtedly gone to the U.S. Senate, and I think that Bernie Sanders would probably say that Ed Garvey would have gotten to the U.S. Senate and done an awful lot of what ultimately Bernie Sanders and Russ Feingold and Paul Wellstone did in kind of forging a new kind of image of a senator who was at once a great legislator, but also somebody who's very tied to movements into issues beyond the Capitol.
And there was a difference between Ed Garvey and the establishment Democratic Party in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, and the establishment Democratic Party nationally. Ed Garvey was always at odds with the Democratic Party. And the reason was that, much like Bernie Sanders now, and of course Sanders' success has caused people to be more generous with regard to him than they were a while back. But the difference on this is that Ed Garvey said 2 decades ago, more than that, even 3 decades ago, that the Democratic Party was way too close to corporate power, and that that closeness was destroying the Democratic Party. He explained again and again and again that if the Democratic Party was not clearly on the side of working people, of African Americans, Hispanics, women, the LGBTQ community, and white folks who happen to work for a living, and he brought all these people together, that it couldn't be, it couldn't function. It would not work.
Here is Ed Garvey from a C-SPAN interview back in 1986. This is before the primary.
Economic matters like that.
Well, I think part of it is just the ability to understand where the problems come from. You know, there's a tendency, for example, in the state of Wisconsin, for the business community to blame the so-called business climate within the state and say somehow that there's something wrong with the state of Wisconsin. In fact, there's nothing wrong with the state of Wisconsin. There are federal policies that make it extremely difficult these days for a mature industrial state like Wisconsin to compete with the Sun Belt and with countries abroad. I mean, if you look at what's happening today with wages in Singapore, for example, versus the wages we're paying, you see multinationals that are willing to shut down in Wisconsin and move their factories to the Philippines or Korea and so on. Clearly, we have a problem of competing. We have corporations today, multinationals, with this concentration of economic power that can say to the state of Wisconsin, either build us a new plant or we'll move elsewhere. And if you don't believe us, they'll open it up for bidding, and you get Minnesota and Kentucky and other states bidding to get that corporation to move to their state. Those issues have to be addressed nationally. They can't be addressed within the state itself effectively. So I think part of it is just understanding where the source of the problem is and how you get things resolved in the Congress.
Those words weren't spoken like that much in the mid-1980s.
Well, you understand, that was before NAFTA.
Right.
Before China Free Trade, before Seattle protests against the WTO, before all the movements that began to identify these issues and to really bring this forward. And isn't it interesting that so much of what he said there, you could say today.
Absolutely.
You know, and this is why, Sly, that I wrote a piece for The Nation on Ed, and did some for The Progressive. So we wrote a few different pieces for different folks. But one of the things that I kept coming back to is that Bernie Sanders called Ed Garvey his hero and his inspiration. Paul Wellstone said that it was reading an article by Ed Garvey that helped him to figure out how he could run for the U.S. Senate. Mark Pocan says that Ed Garvey was his inspiration and touchstone. Tim Baldwin, you know, recalls working for Ed Garvey's campaigns and how that helped her to frame out her ideas and to really identify fully and fully understand the power of identifying as a Wisconsin progressive. The list is incredibly long of people in Wisconsin and nationally, people like Jim Hightower, who reference back to Ed Garvey and say, this guy, at a very critical point in the middle of the Reagan era, unlocked a calculus, figured out how to talk about these issues. Now, he got beat in some campaigns. He didn't go to the U.S. Senate, didn't become governor of Wisconsin. But he framed out ideas about taking on corporate power, literally connecting the battle against corporate power with the fight for democracy, linking up these money and politics issues with a host of voting rights issues and other concerns, and putting that all together and making a politics out of that. And you know, it was so visionary, Sly, that only last year with Bernie Sanders did you see some of those ideas brought fully into the national political context.
Tell me about Bernie stopping and visiting him in the heat of a presidential campaign.
Yeah, that's a great story. Yeah, there's so many stories. Look, Bernie loved Ed, and vice versa. They knew each other for the better part of 40 years. And I never interviewed Bernie Sanders or talked to him where he didn't ask how Ed was doing, ever. Never. It just even in recent months. And it was just a very big deal for him. And so when Bernie came to campaign in Wisconsin, remember, he devoted a full week to really intensive campaigning. And history will record that Bernie Sanders' victory in Wisconsin was really, in many ways, his most remarkable victory. He carried 71 of 72 counties, got, you know, almost 60% of the vote in a state where Hillary Clinton was running hard, campaigning aggressively, where most of the political establishment was not with Bernie Sanders, but with Hillary Clinton.
It was pretty much Paul Soglin, right?
A couple of state reps and, you know, some county officials. So he was running this campaign, and there wasn't particularly good polling. He didn't have an immense amount of time. It was a bit of an uphill campaign, he thought. And so he was campaigning everywhere, going to every city, going, you know, to smaller towns. It was very intense. He was doing tons of media. He was doing speeches, rallies, all this stuff like that. And then one afternoon, it was very interesting. I noticed he didn't tell me that he was going to go see Ed, although it shouldn't surprise me. But I noticed on the schedule that the schedule was just open for a substantial portion. And I thought, well, maybe he's doing some, you know, maybe 60 Minutes is gonna, or something like that. And we were talking. He did a rally in Madison, and he said, "See, I'm going to go see Ed." And he didn't just go see Ed, you know, like pop in the door. He went and spent the afternoon, a good portion of the afternoon with him. And Ed was in, you know, I mean, Ed, it's no secret, Ed was suffering from Parkinson's and struggling with some physical challenges that were really rough. Mentally, he was strong as ever, but physically, he was in pretty bad, you know, pretty rough shape. And Bernie knew he had to go to Ed. And he also knew that it was important to spend time. And he, you know, I don't know if there's another way to say it. I will say it. He sacrificed, you know, a portion of time, which in a presidential campaign is considered the only thing more valuable than money, to sit with somebody he thought of as his hero. And it was pretty special. And to tell you one more bit of that story, in the fall when Bernie came back to campaign for Hillary Clinton and for Russ Feingold, he said, you know, anyway, he indicated he wanted, he was hoping Ed could make it. And so we got a seat right up front at the rally at the Monona Terrace Convention Center. And Ed came. And then afterwards, when Senator finished speaking and when Feingold finished speaking, Bernie said, "Well, where's Ed?" And Ed came backstage. And the two of them stood around talking for a very good chunk of time. And the incredible thing is that they brought Sarah Lloyd into the conversation because, you know, Ed was one of many people that Sarah was one of many people that Ed nurtured up in politics. She was running an incredibly uphill campaign and a hard campaign. Her chances, you know, against Glenn Rothman were a little bit tough, but what's incredible about it is that Ed insisted that Sarah be a part of the conversation because he wanted her to be able to get a picture with Bernie and to be, you know, just to be a part of it. And that was added to the end.
We're almost done.
He's always bringing other people into the game.
Almost done here, but tell us something people would be surprised about Ed the Man away from politics in the limelight.
There's so many things that are important. He had a daughter who suffered from some disability, and he didn't make a big deal about it, but his incredible commitment to her. I cannot begin to tell you that he was an amazingly proud father. He loved all of his kids, but he really stepped up. And as a prominent figure with an awful lot going on in his life, he would always take out time, and it did require time to be a huge part of his children's life. And it was very beautiful to see. I know that a lot of people think of Ed as, you know, incredibly witty and quick on his feet, funny guy, and he was that. But there was also an amazing human side to him. I guess human's not the maybe the right word. It's this warm side, this caring side. It was a big deal. The other thing about Ed that I'll throw in the mix is that at points where the Democratic Party in Wisconsin was most disconnected from its base, where maybe they had some elected officials high up the ladder, but those officials weren't always as connected as they should have been to the grassroots of the party. Ed was the guy that county parties and precinct committees, I don't know, you know, the whole food chain of the Democratic Party, they would call on Ed, even though he was often at odds with the party. And I cannot begin to tell you the number of times that Ed Garvey drove 400 miles, leaving, you know, in the mid-afternoon from his law practice, 200-mile drive someplace and 200 miles back to speak at a county dinner. And he just did it because, A, he believed it was necessary, that you respected those people who did the grassroots work out across the state. And B, and this is, maybe some people won't think it's noble. I happen to think it's very noble. He loved it. He loved getting up there and making a crowd of people laugh and feel good about being progressives. And I guess we started out by saying that he was the embodiment of the La Follette tradition. And I think that just as La Follette loved going to the far corners of Wisconsin to rally progressives, Ed Garvey did.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation, thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
It's a pleasure, my friend.
And SliceOffice.com brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.